First today on Today's Mole, Joshua Holland. Welcome to KBOO.
Hey, thank you for having me. I appreciate that.
Joshua Holland's a writer, notably for The Nation magazine, also for Rolling Stone, the host of Politics and Reality Radio. Joshua Holland, you were engaged in a back and forth in The Nation magazine, a disagreement with physicians for a national health plan over the best strategy to achieve a universal, high-quality, cost-containing health system. Tell us about your disagreement with the single-payer or Medicare for all people.
Well, let me first say that I think that Medicare for all is really smart politics. Medicare is something that is popular, it's familiar, it doesn't seem like a foreign or threatening concept, and I very much agree with the goals of the people that I disagree with on the policy specifics. That is, I'm a strong advocate of universal comprehensive coverage. I think that we need greater equity, universality, obviously, cost containment, more affordability. So we start with a common set of goals. And my concern is that there are two concrete proposals on the table for Medicare for All, one by Representative Conyers in the House, another by Bernie Sanders in the Senate. And my feeling is that they represent the most difficult path to accomplishing these goals that we all have in common. And I'm concerned that they're becoming a kind of litmus test for progressives, that if you think that these are represent a tough path, the toughest path, then somehow you're not a real progressive, or you don't favor universal health care. And the central issue that I have with these proposals is that in a relatively short period of time, they compel the 60% or so of Americans who currently get their insurance through their employer to switch into Medicare. And while that may be a good approach if you were starting from scratch, I believe that that's going to run into some very serious popular resistance. And I would kind of point to this concept known as loss aversion. Loss aversion has been studied really well by economists and psychologists, and it's basically the idea that we fear losing something that we have currently much more than we value something that might be promised to us. And I think we've seen that play out really clearly in the last couple of years' healthcare debates. In the Affordable Care Act, about 5 million people lost very substandard plans because they didn't conform with the Affordable Care Act's minimum coverage provisions. Now, most of those people got better insurance. They didn't lose their insurance coverage. They lost their specific plans. They got something better. In many, many cases, in the majority of cases, because of the subsidies, they were able to get a better insurance plan for less money out of their pocket. And despite this, and despite the fact that the ACA covered about four times that number of people who had been uninsured, those people who lost their coverage became kind of victims of Obamacare and were touted by the law's opponents again and again. And then we saw this same issue with loss aversion come up, I think, with the Republican efforts to repeal and replace. They came in and they looked at polls showing that the Affordable Care Act was not terribly popular, and they thought, okay, well, we'll repeal this. But when people were faced with the idea of losing coverage, the Affordable Care Act became much more popular, and the effort to repeal it became among the least popular pieces of legislation in history.
Yeah, you're arguing the loss aversion argument goes to a majority of people now who are not terribly happy, but they enormously, because they have such high copays, they enormously value their employer-paid insurance. For them, it's very important. It's the reason they stay at jobs. It's crucial for them. And the idea that they would lose that insurance but be promised something better it makes them very nervous and very easily swayed to be against Medicare for All or single payer by this rabid right, which would be joined by the insurance companies, the big pharma, as well as all conservatives and all conservative forces, and a tremendous, it seems to me, expensive campaign of sowing fear.
That's an excellent summary of my argument. And one other point that I would make is that advocates of Medicare for All are 100% correct when they say that we can afford it. That is to say, we spend currently almost 18% of our economic output on health care. But what they get wrong is they assume that a dollar in new taxes has the same political impact as a dollar that's already being taken out of your paycheck and split with your boss for insurance premiums. And I think that that's just clearly untrue. This is, again, the path that is outlined in Medicare for All proposals that we have so far requires shifting almost $1.5 trillion from the private sector to the public sector in a relatively short period of time. And I think that's going to be a major, major political obstacle. Again, I'm not making the argument that we can't afford it. I'm making the argument that the path that we're looking at is really just as difficult as it can be, and it doesn't need to be. There are alternatives.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO. Bill Resnick here from the Mole, talking to Joshua Holland, who writes a lot on many different things. He's been engaged for quite a while now in a debate with the single-payer Medicare for All people who want to straight out legislate the system and change everything. We've been talking about that will create tremendous opposition, and not just, as you pointed out, Joshua, not just from many of the people, probably most of them, which are most of Americans who have now still have employer plans, lousy ones, but they value them, but also for that quarter of the Medicare population who has what is called Medicare Advantage. They're also going to lose their coverage. Losing all of those people, it seems to me, means political disaster. And because that would be central to the next elections, it would undermine, my sense is, it undermines the entire progressive program, because it becomes the signature program it would be in the next election. And the Sanders phenomena, the uprising, the great uprising, it seems to me would just be drowned in all of those fears.
I mean, at a minimum, I believe we need to have open dialogue. You know, when I offered today at thenation.com, I have an alternative path to get to Medicare for All. It's a very bold, very progressive plan. It differs from the Sanders-Conyers approach in key ways, but it's very close to what they're proposing. And, you know, if you look at my social media feeds, you know, you would think that I'm a conservative, you know, arguing for letting the free market take care of things. It's really a problem when we make a specific policy into a litmus test without really debating the merits of that policy. And that's what I fear has been going on so far. That's what I'm trying to fight against. I'm trying to open up this discussion.
Right. Let's talk about the program that you devised. It's full of expansions of health care for all sorts of people, and it doesn't lead to that opposition. Tell us about that program and why.
Well, in simple terms, what I'm suggesting is that we expand Medicare coverage to the poor, to low-income households, to older workers, 55 through 64, and to everybody who's under 18 as a benefit. And then we offer the rest of the population, that key prime working-age population, we offer them and their employers the opportunity to buy into the program, not as a benefit, but at the cost of their actual coverage. And the difference here, it's a big difference But in another sense, it's very it has a lot of the similarities to the Sanders-Conyers approach. Over time, if those of us who advocate single-payer coverage or universal health care are correct, this expanded Medicare program would do a better job of controlling costs. Premiums would be lower, and over time, I think that most employers and most individuals would be happy to voluntarily move into that program. So instead of compelling that group that has coverage right now to give up their coverage, we make it a choice, and we make it an attractive choice, and we allow that process to happen more or less organically. And a key point here is that right now we finance about half of our healthcare through the public sector, but we do it in an irrational way through fractured public programs, right? We have Medicaid administered by the states, we have Medicare, we have CHIP, and we don't have that public health care that we're spending right now in one big pool where it could realize the kind of efficiencies that single-payer systems, that is a key virtue of single-payer systems. So what I do is I roll those programs into Medicare, and then I expand it, and I let that prime working age group enter at its own time pace and picking up its own tab, as opposed to doing it as a benefit through taxes.
Yeah, you mentioned that Sanders is now being critiqued by some of the more militant supporters of Medicare for All and single payer, who insist that the full program be imposed immediately. Sanders actually had the program he brought forward, whenever it was, a couple of months ago. It, in fact, calls for a phased introduction and starting with this expansion of Medicare, somewhat like yours. I wonder if the way of diffusing this instant demand for gratification that is Medicare for All immediately, if, in fact, Sanders adopted a lot of the parts of your plan, it's different. We can't go into all the details, I guess. If Sanders, in fact, and it appears that he sort of understands that problem and wants to put forward a much more comprehensive political program as a way of really building a progressive movement, is Sanders a possibility for that role?
I think that Sanders is much more pragmatic than his most enthusiastic supporters and detractors believe. His proposal still has this key, what I believe to be the key hurdle, which is that it compels that prime working age group in its entirety to give up what they have for Medicare over a four-year period, as opposed to the Conyers plan, which is within 2 years. The healthcare experts that I've spoken to still say that that's way too rapid, would create shocks to the system that are hard to anticipate. I think that Sanders I give him a lot of credit for saying that he doesn't believe that his proposal should be a litmus test for progressives and Democrats. This is the key kind of point that I'm trying to make, is that we should have, again, a broader conversation about those things. And to the degree that he is saying the same thing, that he has his proposal and it shouldn't be a litmus test, I really applaud him for that.
One final issue. One of the interests of our show is to gain us a radical democratization of the institutions of daily life, showing people that they can actually participate, reducing a lot of the hierarchy and also the awe of experts and hierarchs, a sense of, the boss's brains are under the people's hats and should have a whole lot more of a role in organizing and making the decisions in their society. It seems to me the medical system just is begging for that kind of program. And in fact, even under the ACA now, under Obamacare, they've been demanding very different organizations of chronic care, which is the main cost, chronic care, diabetes, some forms of cancer where people stay alive for a very long time and at very great public expense, and their expense and the expense of their lives, that it's much better done when they use, instead of hierarchical physician-directed systems, much more democratic systems that use all sorts of home helpers. That would remain possible under your plan. It seems to me that's for certain, because it does also save a lot of money.
Well, one of the things that is common in my proposal, in Sanders' proposal, and in the existing Medicare and Medicaid plans, is the opportunity to use large pools of insured to innovate kind of different treatment paradigms, different payment schemes that bring down costs while ensuring high quality care. The bigger the pool, though, the greater those efforts are. So, you know, I worry when people say, you know, we need to not pay attention to the experts, because this is a scientific field, and clinical research should inform a lot of our decisions. And that kind of research is encouraged by having these large pools of insurance. I think that, you know, we can see some of the efforts that are already underway under Obamacare expanded greatly if we can get what I describe as a single rate setter plan.
Right. Joshua Holland, we're out of time. Really good talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Right. So long.
Way over the rainbow, way up high, there's a land that I heard of once in a lullaby.